Welcome, everyone. This is 94.7 WPVC, Resistance Radio, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Welcome to Apropos of Something, airing every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. We are very grateful for the sponsorship of the Beckham team at Keller Williams Realty. Today, we welcome back Larisha Hawkins. Larisha Hawkins is a lecturer in politics and a faculty fellow at the Institute for Advanced Studies and Culture at the University of Virginia. She was on this show at the end of April, and at that time, we discussed events surrounding her expulsion from the evangelical school Wheaton College because she wore a hijab in support of Muslims and said that Christians and Muslims worshiped the same God. The events catapulted her into the national spotlight. The Reverend Jesse Jackson compared her with Rosa Parks, and the New York Times wrote a lengthy piece about those events in October of last year. Today, she is here a year and a month after the 2016 election to reflect on race, Trump, and Charlottesville, and to talk about her UVA course, Trump, Tea Party Women, and the Rebirth of a White Christian Nation. We'll discuss this course in depth as it relates to Charlottesville. We will also be talking with Doug Barry. He is an award-winning filmmaker, writer, and producer. He's been invited into the Virginia Film Festival six times since 2004. His film Faux Pas about gay werewolves, mind you, recently won five Best Feature Awards in festivals from San Francisco to Amsterdam. His film Scenes with Ivan, which he made with his wife Judy, debuted at this year's festival. We'll talk about that film, his journey from theater to film, and his encounter with Albert Maysles, and more. Check out all our past shows. We've done 32 to date on the station website, 947wpvc.org, chock full of the amazing people we've had the chance to interview. Nancy, I must ask, are you there, my friend?
I am chock full of being here, Ellen. My goodness, cool. I love this show. Who is on this show? Now, I know, it's
we have an amazing.
I know. It's 33. So how are you feeling about a 33? That's two threes side by side. I just want to clarify in case you were wondering.
I love it. I can't believe that we've had this many so far. And I can't believe that Friday was Flynn Flipped Friday.
Yes, it's like a breakfast item or something. I know. I'm only holding my breath that it actually means something, that they're not going to, you know, that the Republicans and those in the White House are not going to spin it as, yeah, we knew that, whatever, you know, and it just gets that boiled frog theory that, you know,
yeah,
the idea that we don't know that it's already over. The
right.
Coup, that's what I'm holding my breath about.
I want to do a new segment with your permission called Lies, Lies, Lies. Remember that one? Somewhere in there, it gets to lies, lies, lies. I just wanted to repeat that Orange Cheeto has lied 1,628 times, but that was as of last week or the week before, so he's definitely up to more than 5.5 lies per day.
Well, you may need some more music. It might get worn to its nib, and you know, by show 34, because the one thing that we seem to know for certain is, along with death and taxes, or you know, tax cuts, mm-hmm. at this point, each week seems to be worse than the last. You know, he's excellent. He's the best.
Yeah.
At doing that. He's the best at turning each week into the worst.
I'm so mad about the tax scam bill that apparently passed. I think this was the first week where I really had to check the news to make sure what happened because of, you know, the Flynn stuff, which I'm very excited about, and the tax stuff. So I was upset. I don't know. Did anything change between yesterday? The 1% is still getting 62% of the benefits. Individual cuts expire, but corporate taxes never expire.
Right. And they are, as they've been alluding to, when even though they are purporting they don't care about this $1 trillion or $1.5 trillion deficit, there are either it's in the bill, I believe, you know, they are planning on addressing that deficit by cutting social programs. I know it's not the first year in, but whenever that kicks in, the first thing to go will be Medicaid and Medicare and social services and all. And you already know, but the things are already right in front of us, like all the tax deductions for students. I mean, they just, and teachers and working people. They just want us dumb and servile ASAP and dead. You know, it's just amazing.
Yeah, I think we'll talk a little bit about that and some of the culture. I think who don't really want, I don't know. We'll talk more about it, but how people are kept sort of dumb and uneducated.
Right.
Yeah. But I wanted to mention there's an event this weekend, December 3rd, that isn't a political event I usually mention. It is a super moon. Do you know about that?
Oh, no. Go on.
It will be
something out there that he can't screw with. Go on.
True. It will be bigger and brighter than usual. It happens when a full moon happens at the same time that it gets very close to the Earth. And the best time to view it in Seaville is 5:23 p.m. Sunday evening, just after sunset. And for you, 3 minutes later, for some reason.
Thank you, my dear. I'll have that on the side. Okay.
I don't know why you're later. And then I wanted to mention that I heard this really, really loud noise this morning as I was prepping for the show, maybe around 8:30. It sounded like if an earthquake could happen in the sky is kind of what it sounded like. And I went out and there were four huge helicopters with the two whirly bird things on the top, blades on the top, and four of them going north, maybe towards D.C. I don't know what that was. If anyone else heard it, that's what it was. Curious.
So you're presenting this news without a follow up.
I don't know.
I'm firing you from the squad. I want your papers back. You're no longer Scoop Jackson.
I was busy. I was busy doing this show.
Right. Writing about how these awesome guests we have. All right. Never mind. You get a reprieve. Not that I'm the judge and jury here. Well, that is very curious. Of course, it sounds horrible. I'm sure it means something.
I know.
If it was, you know, yeah.
Well, I wanted to, with no further ado, introduce our next guest.
Please.
Our first guest of the day, Larisha Hawkins. She's a lecturer in politics and a faculty fellow at the Institute for Advanced Studies and Culture at the University of Virginia. She was expelled from the evangelical Wheaton College. Today, she's here to reflect on race, Trump in Charlottesville, and to talk about her UVA course, Trump, Tea Party Women, and the Rebirth of a White Christian Nation. Welcome back, Larisha.
Thanks, Ellen and Nancy. It's good to be here.
Hey.
Yeah. So let's talk about what life has been like for you since the election, since we last saw you.
Well, like a lot of people, life since the election has been a period of trying to both reconcile what happened and then also move forward. Continuing with the goal of the show, which is to talk about what it looks like to do justice. I was speaking recently at UVA and to a religious studies class, and the question, the topic was bearing the cross like MLK in the age of Donald Trump, and like what does it look like to continue to do the kind of soul work that we need to do as a country, to think about how we got where we are as individuals, but also as a country collectively. And then also to think about what it looks like to do the footwork, putting kind of feet to that kind of internal work that we need to do, needed to make a reckoning with how we got here, because I think we're all collectively responsible for the moment that we're in. This happened on our watch. Mm-hmm. It happened over the 8 years of the first Black president of the United States, and the things that we see coming to the surface were there before. And it is representative of who we are collectively and individually. And so I think that reckoning is real. And to the extent that we continue to count this as an aberration or some kind of blip or act shocked, it's shocking to the core. But at the same time, the reckoning, the soul work includes thinking about how we're culpable and doing what we need to do in our spheres and corners of the world to make this a different place for now, but also for the future.
What are some ways that, what are some ways that you resist it from being normal? You know, from not just getting used to it. How do you trick yourself?
That's great. I think one of the things is, as a political scientist who was teaching students, it occurred to me that my discipline should be quite relevant to the real world. And in academia, we sit in our silos and we speak back and forth in academic journals. And so from the time I was in graduate school, one of my goals was I wanted to do political science that was relevant to the real world, or at least translatable to the real world. I often am struck by how journalists are doing a lot of the writing and the work, and filmmakers and artists that translate politics for everyday people and mobilize them. So as a political scientist, what could I do in the classroom to translate, I like to say, how do we translate ideas into activism? And so my teaching became a lot about what does it look like, Larisha, as a woman who sits on her butt in a classroom and is teaching students about injustice in the world, but I sit in a classroom all day, and so how do I move myself and move my students into this experiential mode? And again, doing that kind of translation actively in the classroom but outside of the classroom. So part of what I did is I just said, you know, we need to set dangerous intentions, set dangerous thoughts. And so one of mine was like, it was just a prayer, like, may I never make peace with oppression in the world. And it's a simple intention, but the more you repeat those mantras, repeat those prayers, set dangerous intentions. And so I'm convinced that for me, saying, I never want to be comfortable in this place, Wheaton College, I never was. I never want to be comfortable, right? I never want to get comfortable in this place. And then also that I would always be ready to move, ready to go. And then that intention to do justice in the world, never to be okay with the kinds of oppression that we see. So and that moves you. I mean, you can't sit around if that's been your constant, you know, prayer of your life, you know?
So that leads me to ask about your particularly about your course, Trump, Tea Party Women, and the Rebirth of a White Christian Nation. It seems like all these events led you to create that course. Can you talk a little bit about that course?
Yeah. So the course came out of some research that I started back in 2009 with the rise of the Tea Party. One of the things that sparked my interest in the Tea Party was this idea that women saw themselves as kind of mommy citizens, like that their role in the Republic was to have babies and raise citizens. So this Tea Party mantra that Sarah Palin to some extent epitomized, but the women at the grassroots are much more conservative. They don't call themselves conservative feminists like she does. Their husbands don't stay home while the wife works. You know, they're prepping. They're sending their kids to Patriot Camp. They're storing up guns with their husbands. They're canning. And, you know, 60% of them believe that America is a white Christian nation. And so as a woman who was teaching at an evangelical college, I wanted to understand what in my mind was in the media called a non-religious phenomenon, but what I saw as a very evangelical phenomenon. And thinking through, well, where does this come from? And in American political development, this narrative also is not new. It's not new in America. It's not new in American history. It's not new in world history, this idea that women gain citizenship through birthing. But in evangelicalism, it took on this turn of women are saved through childbirth. It's a salvific action. And then that men are saved through their wives, and that this was being translated into politics. And that for me, it harkened back to this 1915 film, The Birth of a Nation, where the country is actually in post-Civil War mode. And the idea is that Africans, black people, planted the first seeds of disunion in the United States. And the film is pointed towards, it's a three-hour film, pointed towards the notion that in order to save America, in order to defend the Union, they had to construct this notion of whiteness, of white togetherness. And the way that they did that was via the vehicle of the violent, racist, sexist, classist, and KKK. And that what I saw happening in the Tea Party was a reinvigoration, a recapitulation of that violent, reactionary kind of right-wing political conservatism, a reconstruction of whiteness. So, you know, white folks invented identity politics. So the kind of claims that we hear bantered about today, I think, are erroneous. And so part of the class is looking at gender, sexuality, race, and religion. That religion is often kept out of that kind of intersectional moment. So that's what we're trying to do in the class.
You know, I was aware from, you know, that certain labels, like even evangelical, can mean one thing and another, you know, people just co-opt a name. So I was wondering if this evangelical attachment to Trump, that, you know, those that call themselves that, does that surprise you that name, you know, and there are people, you know, who identify with that name are on his side with almost every lockstep with him?
No. I think one of the things that is most disappointing about evangelicalism, and I want to distinguish a little bit between evangelicals who are people, the followers, of Jesus, who would call themselves evangelical in the sense of sharing their faith is important, or, you know, believing Jesus saves them from their sins. On the one hand, and evangelicalism, which is the political movement associated. So I want to be clear that I don't think every evangelical voted mm-hmm. for Trump. 81% of white evangelicals voted for Trump. We know that. And I think what I see in evangelicalism is a willingness to say that politics trumps morality in the case of Donald Trump, right? This willingness to cast their lot with this human who doesn't evince, as Jesus would say, any of the fruit. You cast out any tree that doesn't bear fruit. A tree that has married, you know, three or four times. You call people to task who claim that they evince these family values and don't, right? And so this idea also that capitalism is moral. So I'm really convinced that a lot of aspects of American evangelicalism really are what people like to call the prosperity gospel. That really American evangelicalism really is about perpetuating the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism on steroids. So to the extent that Donald Trump is the vehicle of that vision of American exceptionalism and racial capitalism, again, back to the film The Birth of a Nation. The country was built on the backs of slave labor, right? And so this continuation of the racial economic hierarchy has religious roots in this country. So I can't dissociate kind of racial capitalism from religious capitalism and religiosity in this country. And so I think American evangelicalism is really just the hallmark of that kind of American exceptionalism. So it's no surprise to me that since Donald Trump, all of their eggs are in the Trumpian basket, their God is mammon, money. And so to the extent that that's true, it makes absolute sense that they would morph to accept this human, subhuman, whatever, this human who seems to instantiate all of their ideals into public policy. Tax cuts, as Ellen was talking about earlier, mm-hmm. or as you were talking about earlier, Nancy. So
we're coming up to a break. We'll be right back with Larisha Hawkins. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We'll be back to talk about more about her class, Trump, Tea Party Women, and the Rebirth of a White Christian Nation. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something. We're talking with Larisha Hawkins, lecturer in politics, faculty fellow at the Institute for Advanced Studies and Culture at the University of Virginia. We're talking about her very interesting UVA course, Trump, Tea Party Women, and the Rebirth of a White Christian Nation. So, Larisha, I was happened to read this story in Raw Story. And it's a pretty long article that I'm just going to quote a little bit from. It says, the problem, it's just about understanding the Trump voter, and I just wanted your opinion about this. The problem isn't coastal elites don't understand rural Americans. The problem is rural America doesn't understand itself and will never listen to anyone outside their bubble. It doesn't matter how understanding you are, how well you listen, what language you use. If you're viewed as an outsider, your views are automatically discounted. And then another thing. It says that it's just a very closed off system, the fundamentalist belief system. And this is a person who is white, Christian, who spent a lot of time his whole life in that environment. Mm. So what are your thoughts about that?
I mean, I think that it plays into all of the kinds of books. I mean, part of the course was students read this book, Strangers in Their Own Land, that depicts Tea Partiers in Louisiana. And this sense that, again, like this Raw article, which I haven't read, kind of typifies folks as kind of isolated and viewing others as outsiders in this kind of sense of others can't understand. I think that what has happened in this Trump moment is the kind of portrayal of, it's a way of portraying white victimhood over and against black freedom, right? Because what the film Birth of a Nation does so well is it's not only constructing whiteness and a white identity, and even American democracy as quintessentially white, right? Who counts as citizen is white, and who are failed citizens? Blacks, right? So blacks are actually inimical to democracy. When blacks gain freedom, that's the greatest threat to not just white power, but whiteness in and of itself, miscegenation fears, right? Loving versus Virginia. And so these claims of books like Hillbilly Elegy and Strangers in Their Own Land, that we should pity these kinds of white Americans who portray themselves as misunderstood, is really, again, just a kind of recapitulation of that same narrative, that whites are victims of black power or the power of LGBTQ, right? Because the framing is other, or the fact that Muslims are still a religious minority in a country predicated on religious freedom, but to the extent that Muslims are seen, again, as antithetical to citizenship. And recall that anti-Islamic hate crimes are higher now than they were post 9/11. And this is all predicated, again, back on birtherism and the idea that the first black president was Muslim and not an American, right? So we can't even talk about this moment where Donald Trump is framing Muslims as other and Mexicans as other and building a, like, erecting a physical wall, trying to erect a physical wall to keep certain kinds of people out. It goes back to that kind of semi-founding moment, like what the film is trying to assert, that this is an important founding moment, a rebirth of the nation. And the Tea Party Nation is saying, let's take back America. Take it back from where? The blacks and the gays and the Mexicans and the Muslims, right? And so we can't talk about that portrayal of rural whiteness without also talking about, like, who are we saving ourselves from, and who are the outsiders that are making them feel like foreigners and strangers in their own land? It's people like me. It's people like you. And so I think it's important to note that all of those claims center whiteness and say they're talking about class. And that's just BS. It's all about whiteness. Class matters. But it maps on to whiteness in this case. So,
you know, the details you're describing, even though this was a while ago now, but it definitely reminds me of the talk that was unleashed with the whole Lee monument coming down or not coming down, and you got all that, not you, but, you know, we got all that chatter about how it's our heritage and what, you know, and so that became the story instead of how wrong it is that those monuments that represent such, you know, anti-American things, it was way down on the list, you're the guest, so I'm going to shut up, and I'm wondering what you thought about all that.
Oh, yeah, and I also think it's important to talk about how, you know, bringing it back to Charlottesville, how these claims are very much the reason you've got the Hillbilly Elegy talking about folks in Appalachia, right? And you've got Strangers in Their Own Land located in Louisiana, right? Is because place really matters, right? Why did the Nazis defend on Charlottesville? It wasn't just about the Lee statue. It was also about Thomas Jefferson and the claim of blood and soil, right? The claim of place, they're reasserting the notion, you know, marching around the lawn around Thomas Jefferson's statue, right? This is a reassertion of, like, what America is about. It's not just a claim of, like, white unity, right? It's not just uniting the right, the white right. It's also saying this is who we are. Thomas Jefferson epitomizes the ideals that they believe they carry in their body. And that notion of, again, white purity that comes out in the film, The Birth of a Nation, right? It's emboldened by this notion of white Southern womanhood, this purity culture that they need to protect, right? From, again, being stained by the blacks, the gays, the Muslims, et cetera. So this notion of kind of whiteness and white purity, the fact of wearing the white shirts and the khaki pants, everything about Charlottesville, again, is a reassertion of that film in a very visceral way. The images from the march in Charlottesville are just so eerily like the film, The Birth of a Nation, when the KKK comes riding in at the end on their horses with the banner of Jesus riding high in their white robes, of course. But it's the same thing. And Charlottesville as a place, I think people discount the importance of Charlottesville as a particular place that was chosen to perform whiteness, right?
Do you think that rally would have occurred with any other president?
No. Yeah. And I think it's just, it's part and parcel of, you know, the kind of dog whistles that Donald Trump blows and then denies that, you know, I'm not making fun of disabled people. I'm not a racist, right? But they hear the dog whistle, and they knew they had permission, and they knew, and he followed in lockstep, right? There were good people there. So, you know, again, part of what, as a country, we need to do is say, well, to hell with those good people. Good people get other people killed. And so I'm just interested in teaching classes that open my students' eyes to how there's nothing new under the sun, right? This is the story of the United States. This is the story of American political development.
So speaking of nothing new, can you talk a little bit about the, you know, Nixon Goldwater used the famous 1968 and I think 72, the Southern strategy mm-hmm. that redefined politics that right. I keep thinking about over and over, and you know much more about it than I. How do you view that in the context of what's happening today?
Mm-hmm. I think it's important as a political scientist to state that the Trump phenomenon, like what happened, is not new and should not be shocking, because Trump took a page from the Goldwater Nixon playbook, right? So Trump sometimes uses the words, but sometimes doesn't use the words, but he's posited himself as the law and order candidate, right? So if you look back at old political campaign commercials, again, this idea in the civil rights era that, you know, blacks utilizing their freedom to protest for their rights is an abdication of American democracy. It's a threat to law and order. It's a threat to democracy as we know it. So you look at these old Wallace commercials or old Rockefeller commercials, you see a brick thrown through a window and you hear the word lawlessness. Well, who's the ostensible person throwing the brick through a window? It's a black civil rights protester, right? And so when Trump goes to New York and is speaking in Nassau to the police and says about law and order, well, don't cover their heads when you push them into the car. It's a dog whistle. Who is he talking about? When he talks over and over about MS-13 gangs, who most Americans had never heard of, right? And all of a sudden, you know, creates these moral panics. The moral panics are all around black and brown and gay and Muslim bodies. And so the way that Trump deploys the narrative, I mean, we have to give him credit for the way that he does so, actually quite strategically and in ways that people hear and ways that people pick up on quite readily, which again plays back into Charlottesville, this notion that a reassertion of white power in the face of the rising up of Black Lives Matter, right? And the rising up of Muslim Americans, like Linda Sarsour, right? Like we have these icons and the Women's March, right? People putting faith to their soul convictions, about who we should be as a people in terms of our character, but also as a country. And that threat, he's met with that same old kind of playbook that you mentioned, the same Southern strategy. He's just applying it to more people than the blacks, as he calls them, the blacks from the inner cities.
We're talking with Larisha Hawkins, professor at UVA, and we're talking about dangerous intentions and never making peace with oppression. Nancy, do you have, I think we have time for about one more question.
I was just curious, is this class available in the spring? Is it now a permanent part of your curriculum?
Oh, Nancy, that's a good question.
Yes.
Do you know anyone
at
UVA who wants to make permanent Dr. Larisha Hawkins? Well, I'm teaching a class in the spring, which maybe I can come back and speak about, called Race and the Obama Presidency. So part of the class will be looking at the first black president. So we go through the notion of Obama's biography, the ascendance of Obama. Of course, we can't talk about Obama without talking about Jesse Jackson, and the way that Jesse Jackson's presidential bid, and also, of course, Shirley Chisholm, who was the first African-American to run for president in 72, but kind of thinking about how the road was paved, but then about how, because of our racist country, Obama had to run a campaign of racial transcendence. He couldn't run, really, as a black man who cared about a black agenda and black issues. He had, until, you know, Jeremiah Wright, and he had to kind of give his race speech, the famous race speech that he gave. So this class isn't taught next semester. It's gone really well. I have brilliant students. I'm not just saying this because I work there. It's been a privilege and an honor in this time where, not just as a community, but as a country, Charlottesville has awakened a desire for folks to move forward and to be challenged. My students have challenged me. I would be glad to teach this again at UVA, but next semester I'll be teaching a different class. But it's been a good run, and I'm writing a book, so I'll come back Great. When the book is done. And everyone out there in progressive radio land will buy it. So
that's right. We will. Thank you so much for being here. We look forward to Race in the Obama Presidency, as well as your book. Thank you, Larisha Hawkins.
Thanks, Ellen and Nancy. Love what y'all are doing. Keep
it
up.
Thank you so much. You too. I love that. Dangerous intentions and never making peace with oppression. I'm going to remember that one. Thank you.
Okay.
So
yeah, put it to audio, Ellen. It's homework.
Put it to audio, some music.
Yeah, put it to audio, yeah.
So do you have a news of note?
I do. It's the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP, which helps states insure 9 million kids. It has been running on fumes since October when Congress didn't reauthorize it. They've been reauthorizing it since 1997, of course. Nothing is assumed anymore, and they are allowing this program to lapse, and state and federal governments are now relying on their reserves, which, to the fumes remark, to keep it going. And the GOP is allowing this to happen. They're shutting off the federal dollars. They are freaking out 9 million kids' parents because no one knows yet if they're going to reauthorize it, even though they keep saying that they will. Your state, Virginia, has already let families know that they may be losing their coverage at the end of the year. It's just this unnecessary cruelty, considering they do say they just haven't gotten around to it because it costs $8 billion, which, in comparison to what we were talking about earlier, you know, they have no problem blowing a $1.5 trillion hole in the deficit. But this $8 billion price tag needs, you know, considered thought and unnecessarily aggravating so many people. Mm-hmm. I'm done. What do you got?
That was a boo. What I have is the report came out about Charlottesville, the August events, and it is, you can read about it in the U.S. News and World Report story. So I just wanted to mention some of the findings of that report about August 11th and 12th, and also July 8th, I believe. So despite clear evidence of violence, police consistently failed to intervene, de-escalate, or otherwise respond. Police failed to respond when requested to do so by citizens as well. Supervisors devised a poorly conceived plan that under-equipped and misaligned hundreds of officers. Execution of that plan elevated officer safety over public safety. So the area where Heather Heyer was murdered and others were injured, there was an officer there that was removed fearing for her safety and was not replaced. There was poor communication between the Seville police, Virginia police. The report determined that Virginia police intended and instructed state officers to engage in a limited manner. Investigators encountered resistance from multiple organizations, including Charlottesville police, during the course of this independent review. And there is much, much more. It's a 200-page report. Just stunning.
Should we hold our breath that any of these people that made these horrific decisions will be held accountable?
Right. Yeah, it doesn't look like it. I mean, so someone stated that it was really meant for future events rather than the past, which is just
sure
horrible.
Yeah.
Anyhow.
So. What a segue. Here we are.
I know. Usually I'm uplifting. I don't know. That just was hard. So we're going to introduce Doug Barry, and then we're going to go to a break really quickly after, but we'll be back with Doug Barry. So let me get started with talking about him and his work. Doug Barry is a filmmaker. He's local here to Charlottesville. He's a writer, cinematographer, producer, and editor. The Virginia Film Festival invited him to show his work six times since 2004. His film Faux Pas recently won 5 Best Feature Awards in festivals all the way from San Francisco to Amsterdam. And Scenes with Ivan, which he made with his wife Judy, debuted this year at this year's Virginia Film Fest. And the film chronicles their son Ivan's life on video from his birth to present, a span of 32 years. And it took him and his wife 2 years to sift through it all, hundreds of hours of footage, and they looked at things that they'd never seen really before to put this film together. So welcome to the program, Doug.
Thank you so much. So nice to talk to you.
You have a great radio voice, may
well,
I say.
You.
It sounds good to me. So we're going to go to break, Doug. So we'll be right back. We're just on the edge of our seat. I really want to hear more about the film. We'll be right back, all right?
Yeah.
Oops. I didn't mean to hit the boo. This is live radio, and we're going to go to a break. Thanks. Welcome back to Apropos of Something. We air every Saturday morning from 10 to 11. I'm Ellen Daniels. My co-host is Nancy Lawrence. And we are here today with Doug Barry, filmmaker, as I introduced him before the break. We're going to talk about Scenes with Ivan in particular and some of his other films. He has done films called Growing Up with Kaysen, Cold Readings, My Day with Conrad. He's an award-winning filmmaker. His website, I'll mention a couple times, it's DougTypesTooMuch.com. Great title. Welcome, Doug.
Thank you. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. So tell us about Scenes with Ivan. You shot it over 32 years in pieces. How did it become a film? Tell us that story.
Originally, it was going to be a birthday present for our son, Ivan. And we started going through the footage, and about halfway through that process, probably about a year in, we were both looking at each other and going, this is, says so much about everybody. It's about family. It's about, about a lot of good things. And so it was a very positive message, and we thought, maybe this has universal appeal. And we talked to film festival folks, Jody Kilbasa and Wesley Harris, and they agreed with us.
Were you at all wary of putting Ivan's life on film for us all to see?
I think he was more than us. We certainly went and asked his permission ahead of time. And then after we got accepted into the festival, I said, okay, well, now do you want to see it? And he said, yeah, I probably should. And so we sat down and watched it with him about a month before it went to the festival. And he loved it. So we were really happy about that.
Did you keep it a what was the relationship between you and your wife in the film and your son? How was that?
It's pretty interesting. We didn't try to make it a totally Facebook presentation. We tried to show some good things and some kind of awkward things. But mostly we picked small moments that showed us as a family. And it was interesting watching ourselves grow old in the background as well.
Did you and your wife approach the piecing this together the same way?
So what we did was we watched a lot of the footage. We would point things out that we both liked. I'd go in the editing room. I'd cut something rough together. I'd come back and show it to her, and she is the great judge of all of our work. She's got such an astute brain, and she just looks at it, and she has these sweeping comments that change the way that I do everything. And so she looked at it, and she would say, I like this, I like that, maybe a little less of that, maybe a little bit more of this.
So I heard you met Albert Maysles, a very famous documentary filmmaker. I know him most from Grey Gardens, and he's done many things, many, many documentary films. Tell us about that encounter and how that influenced your work.
He came here in, I want to say, 2007. It was a few years before he died, and he was in his 80s at that time, I believe, and he was sharp as a tack, and he brought a whole compilation of things that he had shot, everything from the Queen to the Beatles' first visit to America, which, if you don't know, him and his brother were the two people that they picked exclusively to film their first 3 weeks in America. Martin Scorsese used him on a documentary about the Rolling Stones before he died. So he's very well regarded, and they got to bring him here as part of the Virginia Film Festival series, and I got to meet him at the Vinegar Hill Theater. He just kind of walked in, and I said, "This is the guy." And I had my little camera with him, and I said, "Would you take a movie of me?" And so I'm actually in his unofficial catalog, a five-second film that he shot of me, but it's out on YouTube somewhere. I think it's on my website. So I had this wonderful conversation with him, and he asked me what I was working on. And at the time, I was working on a film called Growing Up Kaysen, which was a documentary about a Charlottesville family. And I looked at him and I said, "But, you know, the problem with my film is it doesn't have any conflict. Everybody kind of works together and they all kind of come out okay." And he had this big smile on his face. And, you know, he said, "Sometimes I get a little tired of all the dysfunction. I think we should have more movies about people that turn out okay."
Uh-huh. Did your process of documenting Ivan on film, for the film, did it change as he grew up? Did you have different parameters as he got older?
We did not. We bought the camera probably about 2 months before he was born, so some of the footage in the beginning of the film is actually his mother's very pregnant stomach with his foot trailing across underneath the skin. And I just took the camera out all the time, and then Judy started taking it out, and we made a deal with ourselves because we didn't have a lot of money at the time, and we said, if we're going to spend the money on a video camera, then we're going to take it out at least once a week. And so initially we took it out even a lot more than that. And so we had a lot of situations where I would just set the camera up on a tripod filming dinner, for instance, and I would film the whole hour of the dinner. And it's wonderful, as Albert Maysles told me, if you don't say anything, people kind of open up and do things you don't expect them to do or say. And so once people got used to the camera being on all the time, it just became kind of forgotten. And you'd find people getting very candid and acting themselves. And so the kid and my wife and the other kids that grew up with Ivan, they were all used to me taking the camera out and handing it to Judy, her handing it back to me, us shooting stuff all the time.
Are you still documenting, Ivan? Will there be a sequel?
Absolutely, because the full cycle for him is at the end of the movie. He's married and has his own daughter, who is his first child that he's had, and she just turned a year old. So,
was that was the impetus, no, for doing the film, or was it to putting it together?
It gave me a perfect ending to the film. I didn't have one when we started, and documentaries are kind of like that. They grow organically for me, and that was the nice icing on the cake at the end.
I'm a little afraid to ask you about faux pas because it sounds funny. It sounds scary.
Oh, it's
both,
not.
Both in its title and what it's about, gay werewolves. So I'm being a little bit facetious when I say that. But tell us about that. Has it become a little bit of a cult film? I mean, I feel like it should.
I wish it would. And I hope people go out to the website and look at it because it is one of the films that's out there. We had I was in a writer's group, and I was writing this film, and I had my brother came, and he only visits about once every 10 years, and so we had this kind of weird kind of Thanksgiving with all the family there, and I came away from that thinking, I want to write a film about family, and then Proposition 8 went down shortly thereafter, and I thought, oh, I have gay friends who have to move to another state in order to be married, and frankly, it really kind of upset me. I thought, okay, I have to get that too. So I started writing this script about a family, and instead of having it be a gay person that was, quote-unquote, the outsider visiting for Thanksgiving, it was going to be a werewolf. And I thought, I'll just take all these stereotypes that we apply to gay people, and I'll put it into a werewolf. And I went through 4 years of taking this script back to my writer's group, and on the fourth iteration, I had the person as a werewolf, and one of the writers is looking at me across the table, and he goes, "Dude, why don't you just make him a gay werewolf?" And I thought, wow, that was a light bulb moment. And then as I'm driving home, I get the second light bulb, which says, buddy movie. You've got to make this a buddy movie. And that's how we got two gay werewolves.
What are their names? Brian, something like
that. They are Brian and Doug. It was our real names.
Okay. And you've traveled that to film fest, gay and lesbian film festivals?
I certainly have. It's been a mix of film festivals. Mm. We've been to some just normal film festivals. Normal. Like UVA that are not genre specific. And then we've been to LGBTQ, and we've won a couple of those. We've been to a couple of horror and fantasy festivals and won those. And that's everywhere from San Francisco. We got a beautiful write-up from the San Francisco Film Critics Circle out there, like something out of Time magazine. And then when we took the film cross-country, we got another review from the American Standard, which is totally opposite side of the spectrum, and they loved it as well.
That's amazing. How are you about showing your films to a live audience? Or does it depend on the film you're showing? But regardless, how are you about that?
I enjoy that experience. I like to sit in the back and watch what happens, and especially with Faux Pas. Faux Pas was, it is kind of a roller coaster ride that works very well in front of an audience, and they really go with it when we they get the joke right away, and they just have this universally good time. And so every place I take it, it's so odd. I have total strangers that come up to me and say, "Can I hug you? That was such a wonderful film." I've had people who come up, even though it is a little language heavy, and they say, "I brought my kid to this, and I would bring my kid to this again because it was a really important message about intolerance, and it's told with comedy, so we try to get our point across that way."
And you can see it on your website, Doug. Absolutely. Yeah, DougTypesTooMuch.com. So go watch it.
And make sure you spell that too correctly. It's T-O-O, much.
Right. If you don't spell it correctly, there's another film you should probably watch. I'm not sure.
What strikes you most now? I mean, actually, I'm not sure how far back you finished scenes with Ivan, but what strikes you now as you watch the film?
Well, I finished it over the summer. Okay. And each time I've watched it, I've had a little bit richer of an experience. We really honed it down to the parts that we didn't think were boring or repeated watchings would make you get bored with it. And so each time I watch it, I think, I like that. I think we did a good job with it.
That's excellent. Is it going to influence your next project or projects?
It is not. My next film is going to be a horror film. And part of that stemmed from going to see Faux Pas in front of horror audiences and sitting all there all day long, 12 hours a day for days on end, and watching the content that's presented to them. And they were so forgiving of things that were lesser projects. But the moment that something came on that they thought somebody had put some thought into, that somebody had done something a little bit differently and a little bit unique, they were just on the edge of their seats. And I thought, I've got to do something for them.
Is it already underway, or how, you know, this... I'm not asking you to reveal anything.
No.
I'm just wondering how far.
It is being written. It's about half written at this point. And my wife, Judy, is going to star in it with me. And she's already a little leery about some of the scenes that I'm going to have her in. So,
how is it working with your wife on projects?
I love working with her. I started out, we did 20 years of community theater together over in Europe and in the States. And she's a kind of an actress that I just have this natural affinity with. I can predict when she's in trouble on stage, and she can predict when I'm in trouble, and we know how to cover each other beautifully. And so when we transcended to movies, that was just a natural kind of move for us.
That's a beautiful synopsis, snapshot right there. Have you ever thought of doing a movie about your relationship together?
Scenes with Ivan is sort of that, a little bit in the background. And I will say that's probably our most personal film that we've ever made, which is the reason it's only going to be shown at the Virginia Film Festival. That was it.
Are there members of your family asking, when's their film? When are you going to document their lives?
No, I think they're scared that I'll do that.
do they pat you down when you visit?
No, but they are a little wary of the camera when it comes on.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Ivan is
Where's that piece of paper I'm supposed to sign for my whatever it is?
No, there's no release for them. No, I own them.
Do you have a preference of, documentary-type films versus something more like Faux Pas?
I love them both, and I think I do that because I like to write, and the two features that we have done, the actors stayed very close to the script, and I even encouraged them because I knew a lot of them were improv actors and could do that very well. And I said, "Would you guys like to try shoot some scenes where we don't go by the script?" And a couple of times I've been told by people that I really respect, "No, what you did is so perfect, I don't want to change it." Whereas the documentary is all this organic kind of process. And with the Kaysen film that we did, I shot a lot of hours of their stuff, and I eventually wound up with this 16-hour rough cut. And I would just watch it over and over, pieces of it every day, and until I got bored with a part, or I thought, oh, I've made that point in another part, and it works well there, so don't have it here. And organically, it just boiled down to this beautiful film that came down to under 2 hours.
Can you talk about growing up Kaysen just for about a minute we have left?
I'd love to.
Okay.
So growing up Kaysen was a Charlottesville family that were all born and raised starting in the Depression on a big farm. And when World War II broke out, all seven of them, even though one of them wasn't quite of legal age, all seven of them wound up going to World War II. All seven came back. Four of them actually started the farmer's market downtown Charlottesville.
That's incredible.
How did you wind up doing this film? I missed that.
Oh, that was quite an experience. I had a friend who, one of the Kaysen brothers, it was, for a Memorial Day weekend or a Veterans Day issue, they had one of them on the cover saluting, and it was a whole article about this family. And so I had a person come to me, and he said, hey, I have a person who works for me that's a niece that's related to them. Would you like to meet them and possibly do a film? And I will say they were a little bit sketchy with me at first, but once they realized I wasn't there to rip them off in any kind of way, either financially or emotionally, they opened right up and gave me these beautiful insights where the family historian said, I don't know how you got these people to say these things, because they said things we have died to try to get them to do, and they will not talk to us about this stuff, and you just got it so easily. And it was that Albert Maisel's advice of don't say anything, just let them go.
Right.
That's so great for people living here to know who the founder of the farmer's market was and that there's a film about it. Is that also on your website, DougTypesTooMuch.com?
Growing Up Kaysen is on DougTypesTooMuch.com.
Fantastic. So thank you so much, Doug Barry, for being here.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Wonderful chatting with you. And we'd love to talk about your next film.
I'd love to come back.
Sounds like he's busy.
Thank you so much.
Busy guy. Thank you. Yeah. Thanks so much.
Take care.
Yeah. Listen, Ellen, I don't want to say anything. I figure there's audio preceding me now, so I'm wary.
Yeah. Okay. I was going to take a picture. I want to take a picture of Doug, you know, for all our social media. So I'm going to do that.
So we're making a documentary picture. So we're filmmakers, too. Tell him.
We're filmmakers, too. Are we?
Exactly. We're very particular. We make one frame, and then we're done.
Actually, you know what's so weird? Yeah, one frame at a time. What's so weird is that you and I watched A Birth of a Nation. I know this is a little bit out of order, but we watched A Birth of a Nation in high school together as part of a film class. Do you remember that?
I remember watching it, being in that film class with you, but I don't remember that being one of them.
Oh, yeah.
My goodness.
Well, we won't bore people with the details, but I totally remember that. So, with no further ado, here's some. Now we have the palate cleanser.
I somehow want to sell, like, moisturizer and soap from the 50s, or if I had any. Pond's cold cream or something.
What's yours?
Okay, well, fortunately, it doesn't quite fit, but I mean, it doesn't disfit. Anyway, mine is something good. Prince Harry and Meghan Markle got engaged this week, you know? Exactly.
Yeah,
miss news like this?
I do.
The couple's first official public appearance was to meet with teachers and students at an art center hosting a celebration for World AIDS Day. And remember sentences like this when we were fixated on she was wearing a full-length navy coat, walking hand in hand, which is contrary to traditional royal behavior.
Yeah.
See, we still can do that stuff. Anyway, what do you got?
Thanks to you, we can do it. This is amazing. Okay, while restoring an 18th century statue of Jesus, restorers in Spain found hidden inside the behind of the wooden statue a handwritten note, probably dating back to 1777. Likely put there by a priest at the church where the statue originated. And it was sort of a time capsule of sorts. So try to picture that visual.
That sounds amazing.
I know. I mean,
it's totally random. Did you say they were actually looking for something?
No. There's so many jokes that you can make out of this, even though it's a true story. But apparently they were repairing it, or they were looking at it, and they saw a little crack in the back, and then they proceeded to see that there was something in there, and it was this rolled up very nicely in calligraphy note in, it looked Latin when I took a little peek at it, but it talked about the time, had information about the time period in the 1700s, details on popular pastimes, the political situation, and things like that. So I thought that was quite interesting.
Anything about sending the information up to an iCloud or anything like
nothing.
That?
Nothing. No.
Okay.
I knew it was.
No one might find that crack in the wall.
I knew it would become.
That's amazing.
I knew it would become the butt of your joke. But.
No.
So, anyhow, anything else you want to talk about? We have about 40 seconds.
Did I mention that Harry and Meghan, he proposed to her while roasting a chicken? I feel like I should get that in there.
Wait, is that true? Is that true?
It's true. This is the stuff that we, you know, we used to. Yeah, I just read that. Well, unless it's fake chicken news.
That's really good.
That is what I read. He proposed her. Well, there you go.
That's good. All right. Well, tune in with us next week on Apropos of Something with my good friend Nancy Lawrence and I, Ellen Daniels, when we'll have the most interesting people that we can possibly find to bring to you on this lovely show every Saturday from 10 to 11. Thanks, Nance.
Yep. Thanks.